Well, last week, we covered chapters 20 and 21 of the book of Joshua. We're marching toward the end of this book. And in chapter 20, we saw the cities of refuge established. Moses had given God's direction for the people previously when they were still on the other side of the river before they had made their way into the land of Canaan. And he had directed that these would be set up and even talked with them about the process that would be used when someone took a life that was not intentional and not out of hatred. And Yahweh had given that instruction to Moses. There were six of these cities, three on the east of the Jordan, three on the west. They were spaced out between the north and southern areas. And the real purpose is when someone did take an unintentional, a life unintentionally of another, that they could go to these cities, they would be safe from an avenger of blood. The avenger of blood had a role of avenging for the family of the one that was killed, that person's life would be taken. That goes clear back to when Noah came off of the ark. God said that if you take a person's life, your life will be taken, and it will be done by man. But if you reach that city, then you're safe from the avenger of blood. It's a way of getting justice for these kinds of things and still retaining justice for murder. And so in the process, when they get there, they go to the city gate, to the elders, and they're given safety in the city until they can have a trial before the congregation. And if their claim of unintentional death is upheld, then they get to stay in the city. And as long as they stay in the city, they're safe from the avenger of blood. If they go out of the city, then the avenger of blood can take their life in accordance with those plans. And they would stay there until the death of the current high priest. And that's kind of a reset. And at that point, then he can return back to his own place if he so desires and move about freely without fear. And we talked about the fact that the avenger, the avenging of the death, is not just to give the offended family justice, it's also God's justice, and we look back to the time of Noah for that. So there were six cities on a map that we handed out, and then we went to Joshua 21. And it was determined by God, directed by God, that there would be cities allotted for and given to the priests, the Levites. And they came to Shiloh and said, it was said that we don't get a portion of land, we don't get a tract of land, we don't get an inheritance of land, but we do need these cities so that we can provide for our families. There were about 22,000 males over 2 months old that were Levites back in the beginning of Numbers, and so there's a pretty large group of people that needed a place, and so the tribes gave them cities, and the cities of refuge are included in that. I didn't have that exactly right, but we got that right before we got done, and I appreciate the help with that. And they not only got the cities, but there were pastures for their flocks, so they too had flocks to take care of, and so they had these cities to be in. At the end of the chapter 21, there are some very clear words that all of Yahweh's promises were kept, and that there were peace on all sides. The battles were over. There were no enemies left standing against them. Now, there were still many people from the lands they conquered still living among them, but the battles were over, and those people should have been driven out or put to death, but with the rest on every side, the statement is made, Yahweh's good promises are complete. And we looked at some passages in Psalms and Hebrews about what it means for a refuge, and Jesus Christ is our refuge and our place to go in amongst our own challenges with sin and attacks from the outside. And that brings us up to Joshua 22. Any questions or comments about what we did last week that you want to bring out that I might have went over in that quick summary? All right, well, let's go to Joshua chapter 22, And I'm going to read the first 9 verses. It says, "Then Joshua summoned the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and he said to them, 'You've kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and you've listened to my voice in all that I commanded you. You have not forsaken your brothers in these many days to this day, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God has given rest to your brothers as he spoke to them. Therefore, turn now and go to your tents, to the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond the Jordan. Only be very careful to observe all the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, to love the Lord your God and walk in all his ways and keep his commandments and hold fast to him and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul.' So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now to the one half tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given a possession in Bashan, but to the other half, Joshua gave a possession among their brothers westward beyond the Jordan. So when Joshua sent them away to their tents, he blessed them and said to them, 'Return to your tents with great riches and with very much livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, iron, and with very many clothes. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers.' The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned home and departed from the sons of Israel at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the land of Gilead, to the land of their possession, which they had possessed according to the command of the Lord through Moses." And so what we see here is Joshua calls together the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. These are the ones that had gone over the Jordan and fought with the rest of the Israelites to take the land of Canaan. That was their agreement when they were given lands east of the Jordan, and they had done that. Let's go over to Numbers 32, 20 through 24 for just a minute. Numbers 32, 20 through 24. And here is the words that were the primary part of the command that Moses gave them. And he said, "And after the land is subdued," this is for afterwards. Go back. "And after the land is subdued before the Lord, then afterward you shall return and be free from your obligation toward the Lord and toward Israel, and this land shall be yours for a possession before the Lord. But if you do not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Build yourselves cities for your little ones and sheepfolds for your sheep, and do what you have promised." And the promise was, when the time came to go take the land of Canaan, they would go as an army, all of their people as soldiers, the men soldiers would go with them and fight right alongside them and do their work as soldiers along with their fellow Israelites. And let's go over to 1 Chronicles 5:18. 1 Chronicles 5:18. I'll warn you ahead of time. We're going to read verse 18 now. There's some other things in 1 Chronicles 5 we'll look at later. But verse 18 says this: "The sons of Reuben and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, consisting of valiant men, men who bore shield and sword and shot with a bow and arrow, were skillful in battle, were 44,700 men who went to war." And so that gives us a look back historically as to their role. They were valiant warriors. They were very valuable to this fight. There were over 44,000 of them that were engaged in the battle, and Joshua's got them together, and he's addressing them with regard to that. In verse 2, he said, "You've kept the commandments of Moses, and you have followed all of my commands." Joshua is looking them in the eye and said, I know what Moses commanded you. You've done well with that. Moses was a servant of God and gave you these rules, and he warned them that if they did not go fight valiantly, if they did not keep that promise and get into it wholeheartedly, that God would know they had sinned and God would avenge that sin. And so here is Joshua saying, you've done it. You deserve full credit for keeping your word as you gave Moses. As well as it was seen also in that the commands that I gave you, Joshua said, in other words, the battle commands, they were obedient soldiers. They did just what was asked of them in the fighting to take the Canaanite area. And in verse 3, he said, you've kept the directive of Yahweh, your God. And so he's connecting it up too as well with what God told them to do. So how long were they involved in this battle? And they went across the Jordan, and they were there with their kinsmen fighting for the land of Canaan. And that's a good question. In Joshua 11:18, we recognize it said that Joshua fought for a long time. And this was probably 5 to 7 years. We know it was at least 5 years. Go over to Joshua 14:7-10. We were here not long ago, but we'll go read it again and get it fresh in our minds. Joshua 14:7-10, and Caleb is speaking when he's asking for the land around that would become called Hebron under his control. And this is what he says. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought word back to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt with fear, but I followed the Lord my God fully. So now Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land on which your foot has trodden will be an inheritance to you and to your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God. Now behold, the Lord has let me live just as he spoke these 45 years from the time that the Lord spoke to me this word to Moses when Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I am 85 years old today. I'm still as strong as I was in the day Moses sent me. As my strength was then, so my strength is now. And for war and for going out and coming in. And so he's there asking for this land based on a promise made when he was one of the spies. And he's making this request 45 years later. He was 40 when he was a spy, and they went in 40 years later, so he would have been about 80. Now he's 85. So there's 5 years that have gone by that they have been fighting this war. And as the land is being apportioned, there's still some bit more warring to do. And some people believe there were probably a couple more years before we see the peace that comes out in the chapter we're looking at today. And so Joshua has said, you have kept this, and you fought for these 5 to 7 years. And verse 4, Joshua goes on to say, now Yahweh has given rest to your tribal brothers. Yahweh has credited you, and this fits in with the end of chapter 21. The promises are kept, the war is over, but there are still Canaanites in the land. And so Yahweh has given them all of the land that was promised. He's kept his word with regard to that. Therefore, now it's time for you to go home, back to the land of the Jordan, which Moses gave you. And then in verse 5, he gives them a charge, because this is very important. He says, only, and that only there is like, pay attention to this. This is a high priority. That's the contextual meaning of that word. Be very careful to observe, which means to do. It's an action verb. The commands and laws as given by Moses, the servant of Yahweh. And then he emphasizes a summary of what that will include. To love Yahweh your God to walk in all his ways, to keep his commandments, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all of your heart and your soul. And that's a pattern that we have seen from leaders as they've been leading the Israelite people. Moses spends a good part of what we read in the book of Numbers telling the people over and over and over and over again, here are the commands, follow the commands, don't depart from the commands. And he gives them even the penalties. If you part from the commands, you're going to fail as a nation. You're going to be run over. You're going to be exiled. Your kingdoms will fall. And so Joshua is here, and he's consistent with Moses. Keep Yahweh number one. Do what you were told by Moses. And it's more than just rules kept. It is serve him with all of your heart and soul. Make Yahweh the issue of your life. That's what he tells them to do. And so here we are, where Joshua is in the process of discharging them. This is also a goodbye moment. And so that also adds importance to what we see in verse 5. This is like sending out people he has led in battle. There had to be something about the fellowship that was special among the Israelites that had fought for the land. And even though God was the strength and the power behind it, they faced death. They faced these battles. And they collectively had followed Yahweh, enjoyed his strength, but had been successful in fighting this war. And so now as he says goodbye to him, goodbyes in those eras were a little different than today. If you have a child and he's establishes a family and decides that England is the place for where his business is going to be, and he picks up and goes to England and takes his family, what are you going to say when they leave? You may have some of these kinds of instructions as a parent. You may have a lot of issues on your mind and your heart. But one of the things you're going to say is, when you get there, and what's it going to say? Call me. There were no phones. Joshua is saying goodbye to them in a way when contact, except through the typical grapevine kind of comments that we talk about today, word gets around, even among nations. They're not so far away that word won't get back what's going on, and we're going to get an example of that before we're done with this chapter. But this is more of a goodbye than what we're used to. And so he is sending them off, and he will no longer be providing leadership and having that kind of contact with them. So he's giving them the important instruction that he needs to give, because it's his last chance to do so. So Joshua blessed them and sent them back to their inheritance and their families. And then in verse 7, there's a little bit of discussion about the rest of the tribe of Manasseh, because half of the tribe is east, and we learn that they are in the area of Bashan, which is the Golan area. It's northern part of the eastern side of what land they wound up with as a result of what Moses granted them. And it's very fertile, rich, full of resources, forests, and that's what they saw when they said, we've got flocks, and it's a good place to raise our children. There's a lot here. It would serve us well. And so they requested of Moses, and Moses granted that based on their promise that they have just now completed. But the other half tribe, Joshua, apportioned land west of the Jordan. And they really, their land is kind of in the middle of the country, and it runs from the river to the sea. And so they've got a large part of central Israel, as it's going to become over the years. And Joshua also sent them to their freshly apportioned land, and he blessed them again. Now, part of the blessing in verse 8 is, return to your tents, and you've got great things to take with you: riches, much livestock, silver, gold, bronze, iron, clothes. And then he says, but divide the spoils of your enemies with your brothers. He's saying, just because you're staying over here in the West, don't deprive the battlemen of the East of their portion as well. And so in verse 9, the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and one half of Manasseh returned home. And they left the rest of the tribes, the 9.5 tribes, there working out of Shiloh to apportion their land, to settle in it, and to finish clearing it out. They're going to the land of Gilead. Gilead is the name for that whole general area to the east. The Bashan is the northern part of it. That word Gilead means hill country. And we need to look at verse 9. There's some very important words there, and I'll tell you why I think they're so important. It's at the last of it. It says, to the land of their possession, which they had possessed, talking about those in the east, according to the command of the Lord through Moses. And I'll tell you why I think those words are so important. I went to a little trouble to find out what I could, hopefully based on scriptures, and I didn't spend hours and hours in this, but looking at, so what happened with these eastern tribes? Were they really part of Israel? Were they seen as part of Israel? And certainly they were for a period of time. But in the course of doing that, I ran into something that I hadn't really thought about in the way it was expressed. But some of the commentators said that the position of the eastern tribes was a diminished position because they had not obeyed God by being willing to go across the Jordan and be part of the tribes and be part of the landmass east of the Jordan, that they wanted to stay to the west. And I think this verse is very important because it wasn't just an arrangement of men. It wasn't just that Moses agreed. It wasn't just that these men asked for something from a worldly perspective. By these men, I mean the ones that were going to stay on the east side of the Jordan, because it makes it very clear they went to the land of their possession, which they had possessed, according to the command of Yahweh through Moses. And so, I don't have an easy way to talk to those commentators, but I would want to ask them, why do you think they were diminished and offensive to God? Now, it would be easy to say that, you know, God was telling the nation to cross the Jordan. But by the time we get here, it's known that the Spirit inspired the writing of this text, did he not? That at this point in time is a command of Yahweh for them to be there. And so if there was a cloud over that, and Moses brought up the potential for a cloud, if there was a cloud over that at the time, and the potential for the cloud was, you're going to discourage the people just like they were discouraged back when we did the first survey 40 years ago. We sent the spies out, and everybody's heart melted with fear because of what the spies said. And so they worked that out through the agreement that they would go do the fighting with the rest of them. They kept that agreement well. And so here he calls it the command of Yahweh according to the Lord, according to Yahweh through Moses. Questions, comments? Okay. Yes, Dave.
Yeah, just an interesting side note on one of the main characters, Caleb.
Mm-hmm.
He was the son of Jephunneh.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Kenizzite. So Kenizzites were Canaanites. So Caleb was half Canaanite. His mother was a daughter of the tribe of Judah. So he was considered to be a Judahite. And he came from Egypt in the Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
So the Kenizzites were present in the land of Canaan. Abraham, when Abraham came from Ur, the Kenizzites were there. So somehow his father ended up in Egypt, married his mother, the daughter of the tribe of Judah in Egypt, and Caleb was born in Egypt and came with the Israelites as a member of the tribe of Judah in the Exodus. So I think that's interesting in a number of ways. One is God had already redeemed the Canaanite and brought them into his covenant people. So that, I think that tells us a lot about the character and the salvific word at work of God.
Yep. That is interesting. I wasn't aware of that, which, and if you continue to plot that out, I can just only imagine what this Canaanite man marrying a Jewish woman in Egypt, that would have been an interesting price he paid.
Yeah, the daughters don't know for sure, but they think, of course, Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt because of the drought. So they think the Kenizzites possibly maybe went with them.
It's possible.
And possibly also were part of the non-Jewish people that came back out of Egypt. During the Exodus.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's their best guess.
Well, and even when Abraham's family moved, I'm stretching my memory, let me say something wrong, I hope not. But I believe they took servants with them.
They did.
And so there could have been something in that population that sent us down this direction as well. So, interesting. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate that. Anything else?
Did the Egyptians have other slaves besides the Israelites that left with the Israelites?
As a matter of fact, I don't know if I want to say that I know they were slaves, but there was another group of people that were not Israelites that went with them. At one point, they're called rabble. And they did cause problems, some of them at least, caused problems for the Jewish people. As they're making their trip over, they offended God really good one time, and I'd have to really work at putting my memory back together to put all the pieces together. But I don't know that they had any big population of slaves, because what we see in the Old Testament, there's a real fear of this Jewish people that are growing so large that they are concerned about what it means for their national security, not to mention what it means for the prominence of Pharaoh. You get two things going at the same time, and every nation has some of that. The people in power want to stay in power, and the whole nation wants to stay secure. So the people in power, are they protecting their power today, or are they protecting the nation today? Sometimes that's not always. Sometimes it's the same thing, but sometimes it's not. In world events today, you could probably go to some situations going on and say, I don't know whether they're protecting themselves or trying to protect the nation or what's going on in some of the battles that are going on around the world. So that wasn't a very complete answer. I didn't want it to be, because I don't have it completely in my head, but that's the best answer I've got. Anything else? Well, let's take a look at what happens in the rest of this chapter. We're going to start out looking at verses 10 through 20 here in Joshua 22. And it says, when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is the land of Canaan, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. And the sons of Israel heard it and said, behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. When the sons of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in a war. Then the sons of Israel sent to the sons of Reuben and to the sons of Gad and to the half-tribe of Manasseh into the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and with him 10 chiefs, one chief for each father's household from each of the tribes of Israel, and each one of them was the head of his father's household among the thousands of Israel. They came to the sons of Reuben and to the sons of Gad and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, to the land of Gilead, and they spoke with them, saying, "Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, what is this unfaithful act which you have committed against the God of Israel, turning away from following the Lord this day by building yourselves an altar to rebel against the Lord this day? Is not the iniquity of Peor enough for us, from which we have not cleansed ourselves to this day, although a plague came on the congregation of the Lord, that you may turn away this day from following the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel tomorrow. If, however, the land of your possession is unclean, then cross into the land of the possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and take possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord or rebel against us by building an altar for yourselves besides the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan, the son of Zerah, act unfaithfully in the things under the ban, and wrath fell on all the congregation of Israel, and that man did not perish alone in it, and this man did not perish alone in his iniquity?" So here these eastern tribes are headed home. And they get near the Jordan, but they're still on the west side. And they built a large altar. It was impressive to see. It was something significant. And as they do so, despite no phones, no Facebook or Twitter, word gets back to Shiloh. And the 9.5 tribes hear about it. What was their reaction?
How dare you?
What's that?
How dare you?
Well, that came, but there's a reaction before that. What was their initial reaction? That was probably still in progress even as they sent the delegation. War. We're going to go battle them. This is not going to happen. Yeah, if you look back at verse 11, it said, "And the sons of Israel heard it and said, behold what they've done. They have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. And when they heard of it," in verse 12, "the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in war." Their reaction was, this is not going to stand. This is not okay. This is terrible. And it's enough to have our first civil war. And then they were barely on their way home. But we're going to have a civil war over this. And so they're headed out. Now, where was this tower? Well, it's on the frontier, but on the side of the Jordan for the sons of Israel, meaning the 9.5 tribes. So it's on the west side of the border. So they even have built this altar on our side of the water, the river. And so this was a strong response. But one thing they did, and I think it showed some wisdom or some patience or maybe whatever, some buy some time while we get our soldiers ready to march. They sent to the eastern tribes, to Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and one tribal leader from each of the 10 tribes, which, if you think about 10 tribes, well, it's 9.5. Well, here they are. One big part of the eastern side is half the tribe of Manasseh. You've got the other half on the east. So even within their own original tribe, they've got a leader coming at them in this delegation. And they go down. Apparently, they built the altar and moved on over into the eastern side, because now they're over in the area on the east, and they meet him over there. And here's Phinehas, their leader. And who is Phinehas? How do we know Phinehas?
He's the guy who speared
the couple.
That guy and his wife and his girlfriend.
And what do we call that? Was the sin of Peor.
And that's what they mentioned.
Okay? And he's the kind of hero of the day, because God did stop what he was doing. Well, it's in Numbers 25. You can look there if you want sometime. But in Numbers 25, it said that they were this stopped the wrath of God. Now, let's just go look at it. I didn't write down the specific verses, but Numbers 25. Having the details here will help us understand the reaction that these people are making. And now I have to get my eyes to pick out.
Proverbs 7.
Well, in 7, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, yeah, you're right, saw it. He arose from the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. Now this is in the last days of Moses. It's not too far off from when they're going to actually be going into the promised land. Before Moses dies, he gets the job of going down and leading or sending out the soldiers to take care of the people of Midian. Why did they have to go down and clear out Midian?
Because it was a Midianite woman.
Well, and it was Midianites along with the leaders of Moab who had encouraged this as a sin, as a way to defeat Israel. They couldn't come against them with their armies because Israel was too great. So they went, let's get them in trouble with their God. And so they encouraged this sin. And so going back to Joshua 22, they go there. They're there to confront them in this whole thing that they've done, building this altar. And what they said to the eastern tribes, what's this rebellion act that you're committing against Yahweh, the God of Israel? Turning away from following Yahweh by building your own altar against Yahweh. How was this an altar against Yahweh? Why did they see it this way?
Because God had him build an altar in the tabernacle that was at Shiloh.
The tabernacle's at Shiloh.
So don't miss
if you're going to bring a burnt offering, a sin offering, a grain offering, they go on the altar in the tabernacle. And so they're down there setting up, in the eyes of the western tribes, they're down there setting up a competitive, non-God-ordained place to make sacrifices. Did anybody else in this era make sacrifices outside of the Jewish people? Yeah. Everybody had sacrificial system of some sort. Even to the point, sometimes it was human sacrifice. Sometimes it were children being sacrificed. It was all kinds of sacrifice. That's how you showed worship to God in many of the religions of that era. And so in the eyes of these Western people, you're down here setting up a worship system that's outside of the way God commanded it would be in great detail, down to the size of the tabernacle, what you're going to make it out of, who's going to make it. All of these things were very exacting in what God gave them, and now you're out here doing something on your own. And so the next question is, as you're doing this rebellion, it was not the rebellion and sin of Peor enough for you? That has a lot of connections coming from Phinehas himself, because not only did he stop what was going on in this sin, and as a result God stopped the plague, God looked at Phinehas and said, you deserve a special care and a special place because you had the same anger I did. You were aligned with me, God says. And so Phinehas gets this status as a man. He wasn't said this way, but much like it would be said about David, after God's own heart. And so Phinehas was not one to be ignored as he comes and brings this challenge. Wasn't the rebellion and sin of Peor enough from you? And then he says, from which we are not yet cleansed, even though a plague came on Yahweh's people. What did he mean by that? Why was it not yet cleansed? Well, there was some of that probably still there. This was the kind of stain of sin that kind of stuck on you. They hadn't outlived that. Phinehas' action did turn away God's wrath. There were people that died by the plague. But it wasn't that God said, okay, the punishment's done. He just stopped mid-punishment. It was about 7 years ago that this has happened, five or more. And there is no mention in the scriptures where they made sacrifices for their sins, where they mourned their sin. I'm sure there was mourning. There was no time of ceremonial cleansing. It just kind of stopped mid-judgment because of what Phinehas did. And Phinehas is saying we still carry some of that. It follows us like a cloud. We aren't all cleaned up in the eyes of the world or the eyes of God. This is part of who we were. And don't you know what happened? And by the way, now you have turned away from following Yahweh. If you rebel against Yahweh to this day, what's going to happen? What does Phinehas tell him is going to happen?
The whole congregation's going to pay.
And who's the whole congregation? East and west of the Jordan. We're going to pay. We paid before. Remember Achan when we first went into the promised land and had the battles and won the victory at Jericho? What happened with Achan? He sinned against God, right? Was he the only one that died?
No, his whole family.
His whole family went with him. You're taking your whole Israelite family down with you. What are you doing? Stop. And one thing you see here is that the Western tribes in this moment, they're saying we're all one family yet. They're not saying, well, you guys over in the East do what you want, but just keep it on the East. No, that's not what they say. We collectively are the children of Israel. You're going to get us all killed. And then I think they make what's a very magnanimous offer, but it's one of self-defense against judgment of God. Hey, if the land you're headed to is unclean, now what does he mean by that? That land would be unclean? We'll come back and answer that question in a minute. But if it is, come back on the west side. We'll give you our land. You can have some of what we've got if you're going to be idol worshipers, if you're on the other side of the Jordan, if you're going to rebel against God in this way. We would rather give up some of what we have than have you go do that and put us all in danger. Now, what does he mean by if your land is unclean? What is he talking about if they're over there on the east side? Well, I think a big part of what he's saying is, if you're already being influenced by living amongst those pagans, and you're ready to worship like a pagan, if you can't stay clean over there, if you can't stay a good God worshiper and a good God follower over there, you need to get over here on the west side with us and we'll all work together instead of work separately. And we'll be glad to give up land so you can do that. Okay, questions, comments? Okay, I gotta look at something real quick. So I need to have a good plan. All right, so now let's look at the rest of the chapter. We're gonna start in verse 21 and read through 34. Oh, come on, turn the page, there we go. So I'm gonna read the rest. Pay attention as we go because my comments are going to happen a little quickly because I've got something I really need to get to before we break up today. Then the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and spoke to the heads of the families of Israel. the mighty one, God, the Lord, the mighty one, God, the Lord, he knows, and may Israel itself know, if it was in rebellion, or if an unfaithful act against the Lord, do not save us this day. If we've built us an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if to offer a burnt offering or grain offering on it, or if to offer sacrifices of peace offerings on it, may the Lord himself require it. But truly we have done this out of concern for a reason, saying, in time to come, your sons may say to our sons, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between us and your sons of Reuben and of Gad, you have no portion in the Lord. So your sons may make our sons stop fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, let us build an altar, not for burnt offering or sacrifice. Rather, it shall be a witness between us and you and between our generations after us that we are to perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, so that your sons will not say to our sons in this time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. Therefore, we said, it shall also come about that if they say this to us or to our generations in time to come, then we shall say, see the copy of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings or for sacrifice, rather it is a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away from the following of the Lord this day by building an altar for burnt offering or for grain offering or for sacrifice, besides the altar of the Lord our God, which is before his tabernacle. So when Phinehas the priest and the leaders of the congregation, even the heads of the families of Israel who were with him, heard the words which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the sons of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, said to the sons of Reuben and to the sons of Gad and to the sons of Manasseh, today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this unfaithful act against the Lord. Now you have delivered the sons of Israel from the hand of the Lord. Then Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the leaders returned from the sons of Reuben and from the sons of Gad and from the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan to the sons of Israel and brought back word to them. The word pleased the sons of Israel, and the sons of Israel blessed God. And they did not speak of going up against them in war to destroy the land in which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad were living. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad called the altar witness, for they said, it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. So the eastern tribes have a reply, and the reply is the great one, Yahweh, the great God. He knows, and we want Israel to know, that if we did this in rebellion, we should be killed right now. It's a very grown-up, serious kind of cross my heart and hope to die if this is a lie kind of a thing. They said it's not an unfaithful act against Yahweh. And so they're very solemn, forceful, and serious in what they did. They said our concern is motivated about what? What was the concern that they had in generations to come?
That they would forget who they were.
Well, they would forget who they were, but they pointed the finger back a little bit at the western tribes. What did they point back and say?
That your sons would decide.
Your sons are going to look at the fact we're on that side of the river and say, what are you worshiping God for? That's our God. And by having this altar there as a witness to say, no, we're both children of Israel. We all worship Yahweh. And so that's their answer to all of this. And so they're looking down the road and seeing that could happen. That's why they built the altar. They have no reason to question what they said. The people there didn't question it. Nothing in the scriptures question it. It's to be a testimony for both the people on the east side of the Jordan and the west side of the Jordan, that both sides of the Jordan, that the sons of Israel were all sons of Israel. And they still pointed their direction back to bringing burnt offerings and sin offerings to the tabernacle, and that's where they would be offering those kinds of things. And it's a way to teach their children, see the altar there, the testimony. Verse 29, it's unthinkable that we would rebel against Yahweh and turn from following him by building an altar for burnt offerings. And so they're saying, no, that's not in question. That's not who we are. That's not what we did. So Phinehas and the priests and the leaders from the west heard this response, and they were pleased. And their answer is, now we know Yahweh is among us. You have not rebelled against Yahweh. You have delivered the sons of Israel from the hand of Yahweh. Meaning, what you say exonerates all of us. We are not afraid God's going to come and crush us now. And so they went back to their western home, Shiloh. They told what was said. And the sons of Israel were pleased. They blessed God. They quit the talks of war about bringing destruction to the east. And the eastern tribes indeed labeled this altar a witness and so on. And so that's what it was for, and that was their intent. But I also want to talk to you a little bit about when I was thinking about, well, what happened with these eastern tribes? I want to go back to 1 Chronicles 5. Too far. And in 1 Chronicles 5, we read verse 18, but I'm going to read 18 through 26 this time, if I ever get there. 1 Chronicles 5. Okay, beginning in verse 18 through 26. The sons of Reuben and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, consisting of valiant men, men who bore shield and sword and shot with bow and were skillful in battle, were 44,760 who went to war. They made war against the Hagrites, Jetur, Naphish, and Nodab. They were helped against them, and the Hagrites and all who were with them were given into their hand, for they cried out to God in the battle, and he answered their prayers because they trusted in him. They took away their cattle, their 50,000 camels, 250,000 sheep, 2,000 donkeys, and 100,000 men. For many fell slain because the war was of God. And they settled in their place until the exile. Now the sons of the half-tribe of Manasseh lived in the land from Bashan to Baal Hermon and Senir and Mount Hermon. They were numerous. These were the heads of their father's households, even Ephir, Ishi, Eliel, Azrael, Jeremiah, Hodaviah, and Jondael, mighty men of valor, famous men, heads of their father's households. But they acted treacherously against the God of their fathers and played the harlot after the gods of the peoples of the land whom God had destroyed before them. So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, even the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, and he carried them away into exile, namely the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them to Halah, Habor, Hara, to the river of Gozan to this day. So what happened? In the war, they were calling out to God, and God was answering their prayers, and they were trusting in God. After the wars are over, here they were, and the altar they built was convincing that it wasn't intended to be an alternative worship. But they went home, and the exiles came, both to them and to Israel, from Assyria. Who empowered that Assyrian captivity? God did. Why did God, it doesn't say that right here, you'd have to do some more looking to find that. But why did God allow the northern tribes and the tribes to the east to fall into captivity? It does say that here.
Yeah.
They played the harlot, they worshiped other gods. And these tribes east of the Jordan got hit first. Why? They were closest to Assyria. And so they were in a more vulnerable spot because of their location and where the attack was coming from. And so they got hit first. But it isn't going to be just them. They're going to go get the northern tribes as well, what we would call Israel later, or Samaria. Judah will be taken by different forces, but for the same reasons. What went wrong? And I think,
They stopped following.
Well, but why? And I think there's two reasons for it. One is, they were part of mankind. And mankind has a bent toward sin. We just do. It's a lifelong struggle to keep sin pushed back or to push it back every time it enters. And nobody gets out of that struggle. We're all in that struggle. We would hope that as life goes on and we become more accustomed to it, we get better at it. But you can see the direction that nations go. They'll have a peak moment and then they'll decline. And why did they decline in these cases? What happened to the North Kingdom, the South Kingdom, and the people on the east side of the Jordan? God had told them, you've got to get out the foreign god worshipers. Instead, they got comfortable with them. It's easy to get comfortable with the conditions of life, particularly when you come out of a war. People are ready for peace. There are people in the 60s I heard say, when the Cold War was at its strength, we should have taken Russia out when we had the ability after World War II, but people were done with war. I don't know if that would have been wise or not. I'm not trying to say anything about those decisions. All I'm saying is nobody had a stomach left for war. And these folks, once the war was over, when things calmed down, they quit thinking about the very clear direction God had given them and about not allowing foreign god worshipers to stay in their midst, because God said, what will you do if you do that? You will follow them. And what did they do? Lo and surprise, they followed these foreign worshipers. I spent a lot of my years teaching about or studying about accidents in other places in the nuclear industry, so they wouldn't happen here. A real common thing that happens in accidents is what we call lack of situational awareness or complacency. We're in a war. 1 Peter 5 says that Satan prowls around like a roaring lion looking for people to devour. And if you're comfortable with that, you're vulnerable. Don't be comfortable. Think about what in your life have you become comfortable with that puts you in jeopardy and danger. You're not going to do better than these folks if you don't deal with those things that will take you away from, cause you to rebel to the Lord your God. Questions, comments? All right, we'll see you next time.